Welcome to Michigan Hockey Cast 5.21, where we love winning trophies and hanging back. Alex, we've completed three as of Saturday night. And that, of course, what I'm referring to is the watch-alongs, which I think I've heard have kind of gotten better as we've done them. I think we've gotten more comfortable and used to it, obviously. But we've also sort of been kind of blessed with games that you would want for watch-alongs, right? I mean, because the first Michigan State game was... You know, Michigan was up to a lead, and then there's all the hoo-has in the second period, and then they kind of hold it, finish it out, and we're kind of excited. And then, obviously, we get the marathon basketball game against Illinois that there's lots of emotion there. And then this was probably the most entertaining hockey game of the season?
Maybe. What I'll say is the first period of the watch-along was probably our worst, like 30 minutes on a watch-along to date.
So is that on us? I mean, the first 20 minutes of the hockey game.
No,
on
it was
Sunday,
the hockey game was very boring. Yeah. We just didn't have a lot of backup material to plan to talk about in that scenario.
But we can't like talk about news during that time, right? I mean, like you have to talk about what you see at that time.
Yeah. I mean, you can play on the edges, but and then once the things started happening, then it was. It was quite interesting after that.
So we had Alejandro in the room, too, and I mean, he was very good. He kind of, like, really fit as somebody who just, like, was going to be a contributor.
You know, what I really thought about and what it reminded me a lot of was the first days when I was doing play-by-play for the first time on the air. And because when you're on radio, the biggest thing you have to remember is time and score.
Yeah.
So I would have older people doing, you know, color with me, and then, you know, I'd have a post-it note, and they'd hold it up and say time and score, and then he was doing that a few times.
Yeah, he, like, held up his laptop. Yeah. He would write things on his laptop and then show us.
But that's how it works. Yeah. If you have spotters in your booth, like, if you've been in show business, you know how it works.
Yeah. I also think, like the rapport went really well. I mean, Brian's just an entertaining hoot. He's going to pull stuff out of... I don't know where he gets half of his stuff. It's kind of scary, like, what's actually going on in his mind sometimes. But just to be able to do that, like you said, and to keep people engaged.
Yeah, the dynamics work well.
All right, so it seems like this is probably a thing that we're establishing, and it... You know, I know there's all, like, the... chatter about you gotta do this for football and that sort of thing, and I get
hey,
it.
I've never been opposed to it.
You have.
I'm the man of the people here. I am willing.
Is that
to
how give, you view yourself?
I'm willing to give them they want.
Are you so. Always among the throngs and like high fiving and glad handing folk?
No, but I'm the one who is in agreement.
You would be willing to do it. I think that, you know, maybe there are very specified conditions that would have to be met. The problem is, you know, people go to games and that sort of thing. You could do, you know, a random road game, I guess. The Michigan doesn't have a ton of those. And, you know, there may be some that you...
I've said we could get Craig and then, I don't know, who...
Craig also goes to games.
No, I'm talking about a road game.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean,
But who else would not be too riled up to do it?
Well, I mean,
we have to put Brian in another room because he's going to start throwing things.
Well, then. I mean, Brian's the feature, right? I mean, it would be Brian and Seth and you and I is what I would guess it would end up being. Because, I mean, what else are you going to do? But anyway, it seems like those are good, and it seems like, you know, they will at least continue for some sports going forward into the next year. Probably not this year unless you and Craig want to do a masochistic softball watch-along.
There's no reason for that.
Should we see if the viewers want that? We could ask them.
No.
Alex is just shutting this down. So, anyway, that's a good idea. I think it was pretty well executed, and I think there should be more of those going forward. Yeah?
Yeah, I gave it the 1.3 designation on the
As we're starting to build?
Well, that's when it went from experimental to just like, this is, you know, the podcast numbering.
This is a thing. Yeah. All right. Well, we'll transition to the first segment, which is just going to be talking about the Big Ten championship game against Minnesota. And then in the second segment, we'll take a look at the tournament bracket and, you know, mostly, you know, Michigan's regional, and then kind of dabble a little bit in the rest of them. But how they got there, you know, coming into this game, Michigan was, I mean, it wasn't done, but, you know, it seemed like their ceiling was going to be the four overall, right? And that's not what ended up happening because of a lot of things that happening.
So I'm not sure if, I don't know. I don't know how to phrase this.
Okay.
But I don't know if actually the 2% scenario happened, or if College Hockey News' matrix is a little
glitchy.
I don't know. If their probabilities are just a little off. Because Denver losing on Friday night to CC, which was a big upset.
Yeah.
It was probably like an, for you, their probabilities, because they go off K-Ratch. So their probability for that was probably like 85-15, maybe 80-20. And then I know, you know, QPAC lost that night too. So there was a few things going on, but like the Denver one was the big one. And then like because of that, it went from 2% for three to like 30-some percent.
That which seems is like a lot.
It's like a big jump.
Yeah.
And so like I don't know if actually one of the 2% outcomes happened, or if they just some things are a little wonky, right? It's like they don't show their math.
Yeah.
So like if you think about other models, like the 538 election models, right? They'll show you what the 1% outcome is, right?
I see.
It's like 500 electoral votes for some candidate. Whereas in this case, they don't show you what that 1 or 2, like what needs to happen to get that 2% outcome to happen.
They just show you
it just says it's 2%,
the result.
But you don't know if it's what actually has to happen to get there.
But they're all just giggling behind the scenes because
it could be. I don't know. But it just felt like, when I looked at that updated matrix, like, remember Brian walked in and he was like, well, we have no chance for a three, right? I'm like, no, actually, it's like a very real chance. And it's like, it was 2% yesterday. And
yeah.
So I don't know. I don't know exactly what's going on with that, but a lot changed. And by the time the game happened, the scenarios were very different than they had been previously.
Well, the Michigan-Minnesota game started with a tradition, which is Michigan winning a faceoff, going back into their own end, and turning the puck over right away. It was Luke Hughes and Keaton Pearson who kind of one of them fumbled the puck in the corner. It gets kicked out to the high slot, and Portillo is called on to make a really nice save before we'd even digested that the game had started.
It was a quick jump, but didn't affect the scoreboard, so.
You know, some goalies like to get into the game early. Maybe that's like Portillo's thing, is he's like, hey guys, give him a good shot early because I just want to be ready to go.
Yeah, so analytics people have studied this and like they say there's nothing there, but goalies will insist there is.
Regarding?
Just all of that kind of stuff where goalies say stuff like I want a shot early or I would much rather play a game where I face 45 shots than 15 because I stay engaged and stuff like that.
But
empirically, there hasn't been proven anything, but
I don't think you can prove those.
All the goalies would say that.
I don't think you can ever prove that because that's more of a preference or an emotion.
Sure.
And so,
sure, if you view it that way.
I mean,
it's just been empirically tested on save percentage outcomes, for example.
Sure, I get that. But I'm talking about maybe like comfortability in net and how you feel
and
when
that,
you're moving.
That, there's no... You know.
Yeah, it's just certain guys are going to prefer certain things. Anyway, but Portillo comes up big pretty early on. And, you know, this first period's going to go pretty quickly because there was not a lot of events that on either side, really. I think the period ended like 7-6 in shots on an Olympic rink with two of the most skilled teams in the country, which you would think would not happen. But as you had said, both teams are probably feeling each other out, trying not to make a big mistake, and just seeing if they can take advantage of something. Minnesota does get to take advantage of a Luke Hughes mistake as he shoots the puck. He crosses the blue, or he's in the blue line, inside the blue line, takes a shot into two oncoming Gophers, and the shot ricochets out into the neutral zone, where Keaton Pearson does get back to play a 2-on-1, but plays it poorly, as I believe it's Cooley that comes down the right side and is able to pass it across to Brody Lamb, who easily beats Portillo for the opening goal for the Gophers. You went back and looked at this and said this was We I thought it was great because Brian and I on the watch along talked about the poor decision from Luke Hughes, which is very true, and you were able to diagnose and figure out what Pearson did wrong on playing the 2-on-1 itself.
Yeah, I mean, Hughes definitely makes a mistake here. It's an odd mistake, first of all, because you think about what is, like, in 4 years, almost, of Hughes hockey we've gotten to watch.
Between what is the double coin and
like
the double
loop. Defining thing? It's that they have a certain slippery ability on their edges from the point to shake defenders and open passing and shooting lanes.
Yeah.
And in this situation, it just would so obviously be one of those situations. He gets a puck low to high in the slot. Two guys come at him. This is just a classic Hughes opportunity to just cut to the side, cut around in the middle, and all of a sudden you've got numbers down low.
Yeah.
Like it's, and then instead, he decides to shoot and, you know, he fires right into them and now it's a rush going the other way. But as I always talk about, giving up rushes is not leading to goals. There has to be at least either a break, unless it's 2-on-0, there has to be either a goalie breakdown, not making a save in a 1-on-1 situation, or a defensive breakdown where a pass came across. And in this situation, you know, Keaton Pearson just doesn't really do anything here.
Well, you're taught in that a 3-on-2 works differently, but a 2-on-1 is you either have to take the shot or the pass. I mean, if you can do both, it's sort of like, you know, taking the pull and the give as a defensive end, but you it's very hard and almost impossible to do both. And so what you're taught in those situations is most goalies would be like, look, don't let the pass across and I'll make the save. And Pearson doesn't really do either.
Yeah, he, you know, first of all, Logan Cooley's coming down the wing. Yeah. And I don't know, obviously, how aware Pearson is, because the numbers are not on the front of the jersey.
Sure.
But how aware he is of which players this is, because on the scouting report, you know, I'm telling him, if you're in a situation like this with Cooley coming down the wing, just take the pass all the way. Don't even respect the shooter. If he beats Portillo, let him beat Portillo. But this is a pass-first player. This is a player who was drafted because of his passing ability. If Henrik Sedin's coming down the wing, you let the guy shoot. Let him shoot, just don't let him pass. That's his thing, right? And it depends on the player you've got. But Cooley there, you know he's going to look to pass first. You just know that. That is what his skill set is. And he kind of comes over and bites a little bit and waits for the shot, and then the shot doesn't come, and he tries to fall back and take a pass, and so in the end, he doesn't do anything.
Yeah.
And I think ideally, if you want him to take the pass, it's hard because some people don't like the diving slide, because some guys are really bad at it. I happen to get to watch TJ Brody a lot of the time, who is one of the best ever at that one specific play. It, when executed well, it just totally takes away the pass unless it's a saucer up in the air over a body, which is a hard pass to execute. I don't know what Keaton Pearson's skill set is, but at the end of the day, whatever move you're going to try to do, you just got to take it away.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Especially, again, when you're with a player who's got the puck who is a pass-first player and who's going to be looking to pass in all the situations.
He doesn't do that. He doesn't really do anything. The pass gets across. Lamb finishes. That's 1-0. And
this is an interesting shot by Lamb, by the way.
Okay.
Because at first value, it looks like it's a one-timer, but it's not. The pass comes across. Lamb waits about a fraction of a second, and he gets to see Portillo come across and then pick his spot. So it was not a situation where he beat Portillo because Portillo wasn't over. Portillo's over, and he just picked the spot.
So it's a good shot.
Good shot, yep.
So it's 1-0. Minnesota, and as we reach about halftime through the first period, it's 1-0, and then shots are 4-4, and you're just, you know, both teams can kind of get the neutral zone. Nobody's really establishing anything in zone. You know, Minnesota does get another 2-on-1, but their pass across goes through the guy's legs, so they can't really take advantage of that. That was not as crisp of a 2-on-1 in terms of, like, the positioning of the players, and they don't get anything from that. Jackson Hallam is called for interference. Next, this is something that we've debated, too, about. I think we talked a little bit about this on the watch-along, which was, you know, do you like the interference at the blue line stuff? You know, sort of picks and all that sort of thing. And I feel like you've mentioned to me before that you like things that benefit offense.
Yeah, well, this isn't at the blue line. This isn't what Brian is always talking about.
Okay.
Brian's talking about, like, when the guy's at the blue line trying to hold the puck in, and then a guy is rushing the other way. Like, the puck gets chipped in. Like, the guy's at the blue line, he fumbles it, it rolls past him, and then they, like, kind of collide there, and sometimes those get called as interference. This is a totally different thing. And this is a play that featured very prominently in the playoff series last year. If you recall, the Tampa Bay Lightning in the first round against the Toronto Maple Leafs in Game 7.
Yes.
There was a goal that John Tavares scored that was disallowed because the whistle had blown moments earlier on this exact play. And now I see it every single time. Every single time when I see this play happen, I'm like, it's a Justin Hall pick play.
Yeah.
Got a puck carrier coming around on the perimeter. You got another guy coming that way, sets the pick. Puck carrier curls to the slot, and all of a sudden he's got a ton of space because the guy on him just got taken out by the pick. It's interference. It shouldn't be in my ideal hockey. I think if you come up and you stop and you set the pick, because you can't have guys coming through and just blasting each other.
Well, yeah.
Because that's charging. Like,
yeah.
So that, you can't have that.
Yeah.
But if you have a guy coming across and, you know, you'd have to write a rule a certain way to say, because you can't say he has to be totally stopped, but, you know, little contact, like the guy can't fall down or whatever, right? Just like the small little brush. But what it would do is exactly that. It would help offense. Because in both of these plays I just mentioned, what's the result if it's not called? A shooter in the slot, in tight for a grade A scoring chance.
Yeah.
If suddenly you could do that and you can draw plays to get space in the offensive zone because of picks, it would absolutely help offense. And I'm always for that. I'm in favor of a lot more interference being called in the defensive zone on the defensive team, and I'm in favor of a lot of less interference called on the offensive team. So this is, you know, Hallam didn't clock the guy, right?
No.
But under the way the rule is written, it is interference, and they were correct to call it. So, you know, this is my, like, most Brian or Craig thing, right? Like, you know, I don't really go for the, like, oh, it should be five balls for a walk or whatever, right? Like, I don't come up with hokey stuff like that, but the you know, basketball-style picks should be legal, right? Because, you know, basketball, you can't set a moving screen
no.
to stop. So,
yeah.
Like, some version of that, I think, would be very cool and would lead to increased offense.
Well, that rule has not been implemented yet, unfortunately for Jackson Hallam, and he had to go to the box. Minnesota got their first power play. This was a really big moment in the game because they had a 1-0 lead, and getting a goal in the back half of this period,
yep.
taking a 2-goal lead into the break, and all of a sudden, you know, you're just feeling a lot differently about the rest of the game. But Michigan actually does a pretty good job and kills it off. Estapa actually had a chance on the penalty kill, but it was saved. Portillo made a couple of nice saves here. This was probably one of his better ones. He had a big pad save on a pretty decent chance from near inside the house, so just inside the house. And so overall, I thought, you know, this was something that Michigan struggled with against Ohio State the previous weekend and had struggled, you know, off and on throughout the year, is kind of cleaning these penalty kills up. And this one was pretty good.
They did fine on the penalty kill, and, you know, there's maybe one look Minnesota gets, but as we always say, your goalie is your best penalty killer.
There it is. That's about all I have for the first period.
No, that's what I meant.
Oh, okay. So going into the second period, I felt fine. Like, I didn't think Michigan played poorly. They had one bad breakdown that led to a 2-on-1 and then a breakdown of the 2-on-1 that led to the goal. You know, they didn't get a power play to match Minnesota's. They didn't really have many great scoring chances, but, you know, it's the first period and they're not out of the game, so you're not excited, but they need to pick it up a little bit in the second period.
You don't need to go pedal to the metal when you're only down one with 40 minutes to go. Just stick with what you're doing. You're not getting, you know, whipped or anything. These two teams were just kind of, again, you know, kind of locking horns in some ways.
Yeah, I think you mentioned
that.
They
were both just in their neutral zone forechecks, both very interested in not giving up a ton of rush chances, not interested in really making mistakes. And it led to low event hockey. But what I said going into that second was just keep doing it and see if you get an opportunity to arise and just stick to what your game plan is and see if you can start to win a few more battles in the offensive zone and then get a chance if it pops up.
So the second period starts similarly to the first, where we have another Luke Hughes defensive zone turnover, and there's kind of an open net, but the puck just could not get find the Minnesota stick, and so Michigan dodges that early bullet. But then it gets a lot better and kind of goes along with what you're saying, winning more puck battles in the offensive end and sticking with your game and maybe turning up the forecheck a smidge. And that's what they did, as they started to turn Minnesota over. The fourth line did that a number of times. And Michigan gets the equalizer when Gavin Brindley kind of swoops behind the net, getting away from a defenseman, clears the net on the far side and hits a streaking Ethan Edwards down the slot, who rifles a shot in that close makes the save, and Rutger McGroarty is right in the perfect spot in the slot for the rebound, and he fills it up, and it's 1-1.
Well, the real hero of this one is Nick Granowitz. He makes the whole play happen. He just takes the puck away from a gopher in the corner. He hounds a defenseman, takes it away, wins a board battle with two gophers right there, and then that allows Brindley to be on the puck, and then he goes to work. But that was kind of what was not happening in the first period. You weren't stripping the gophers enough, and Granowitz gets involved and does turn them over, and that starts the whole play. And, you know, Granowitz drives the net as the shot comes in from Edwards, and you have a couple gophers on the ice who are just a little bit snoozing. You know, that you can't box out properly like you can in basketball, but they are standing there, and Rucker McGroarty shoots right by them to siphon up the rebound and plunk it in. So Rucker really read that play well, but it all gets started by Granowitz in the corner,
taking the puck away. So if you like that play, you're going to love this play because it's not too dissimilar, but Michigan again gets in the zone and obtains the puck. The puck comes back. I think McGroarty makes the initial pass back to Keaton Pearson, who takes a shot that misses the net just wide, but at the perfect angle that it kicks out the other side. And McGroarty is sitting then far post where the puck comes back out, and he taps it in for another rebound goal and a 2-1 Michigan lead. Both goals, I believe, happened in about 34 seconds.
Yeah, this goal's all luck, and sometimes you need that to win a big game. It was not a pass back for Keaton Pearson. It was a shot by Adam Fantilli right off Jimmy Snuggerud, right into a shooting lane for Keaton Pearson.
Okay.
Who then takes a shot that misses by a mile, but bounces right to Rucker McGroarty.
Well, he missed it by about
a
foot on the side.
Sure, but it misses the net, and it hits in a perfect spot to bounce down. So you get two lucky bounces in the span of about 3 seconds, and it puts a guy right on the doorstep with an open net, and Rucker converts. That's what hockey is. That's why we hate the NCAA tournament so much, and why we hate this event. It's really bad. It doesn't always award the best winner because of plays like this, although Michigan was the better team in this game. Sometimes it's a lot of bounces, and you wake up finding out if you're going to be the lucky one of the day.
Well, and then the fourth line kind of gets into it. As Michigan, that was one of the biggest keys of this game, is Michigan is able to put out every one of their lines and be able to generate offense and chances. And they are able to control the puck as well. That's something that, you know, hasn't always been the case, where they've had to been reliant upon their top line or a hot line for the night that's playing really well. Michigan really got it going with all four lines. Now, the fourth line didn't score, but Estapa and Moyle and Granowitz, like you were saying, were great on the boards, especially after that first period, just taking the puck away, forcing defensive zone turnovers. And, you know, Estapa had a good chance in front, and Moyle had a good chance in front. Close, I thought, was pretty good at times in this period, keeping Minnesota in it, because Michigan kind of changed the game statistically, at least, by increasing their expected goals and just chances in and around the net. But Close was there every time after that 34 seconds.
Yeah, Close he did a fine job in this period, and then it kind of got to this point where Michigan is cycling really well and controlling play, and what we were sort of saying at the time was, or not we, I was saying this, but
I mean, it was being discussed.
I brought this up not long before the goal happens.
Yeah.
And I said, look, you get in a situation where you're cycling like crazy, what can happen in those situations? You have a lot of times, because you got the pressure on, you want to keep the foot on the gas. That means having your defense getting involved, facilitating the cycle, doing the sorts of things that Ohio State has done against Michigan, we talked about last week. And so you're getting harder pinches, you're getting defense rotating down in the zone. That means you get forwards up high in puck support. And you kind of get in that moment where you just want to make the next right pass, next right pass, next right pass. But if you're, let's say you got a defenseman in a corner, and then you got a forward going low to high up the wall to a defenseman or another forward, all it takes is one stick.
Yeah.
Pop that puck out, and all of a sudden, it's a two-on-one the other way, right? Like, you just get exposed if you start really going crazy. And so you kind of tread that line. And they were really ramping up the pressure, hoping to get that big third goal.
Yep.
And instead, it ends up exactly what I was worried about happening. And it was really the result of the long change in this period that did it.
The long change played a really key role because it was Cooley that was coming off the ice where he was, or it was either him or Snuggerud. And it, again, the top line, I mean, that's been the key for them.
No, Snuggerud was way up ice. It was Cooley who was in the zone. He was the one racing back.
So
Cooley or Snuggerud had just come on.
Yeah. So what had happened here is Michigan turns the puck over in the offensive zone. Casey's a little bit down. Edwards is going forward as the puck is turned over. So neither one of them is kind of going backwards or has momentum to on the defensive side. Both of them are contributing offensively, and the puck gets out through them, and it looks like it's Snuggerud that gets down the other way, and then there's a 2-on-0, and Portillo, I mean, I think you made this point, and I saw it immediately then and agreed with you, was, you know, on a 2-on-0, it's the thing where you just pass the puck back and forth, right, until somebody has basically an open net, and Portillo comes out and baits him into a pass and dives, taking himself out of the goal, obviously, but his only real hope is to deflect the pass if he can bait him into it, and he almost gets it, but does not. The puck does get across, and it's pretty much an open net.
Yeah, this was one that, so our friend-ish of the podcast.
Friend-ish?
J.D. Jerbear,
okay.
Our Michigan State guy, he was on Twitter talking about Portillo and about this play in particular, and I was kind of thinking, like, you know, this is a more complicated one, I think, that we've talked about Portillo a lot. And I didn't think that this was one to use as an example of, like, Portillo being a question mark for the NCAA tournament, which I still think is definitely the case. I don't think this play is the one that like, showcases that.
No, I think he does a good job.
He makes a decision here. It's definitely an odd decision. It's definitely one a lot of goalies would not make. But you don't have many good options here.
No.
Most all goalies today are going to just take the shooter, slide across, and hope the guy misses the net. For the most part, that's probably what's going to happen in most cases nowadays.
So the difference with Portillo he's very long.
He decides to do the 80s goalie thing, where, you know, you come way out and try to cut the pass off entirely yourself. And it's taking matters into your own hands. I'm not a huge fan of the poke check and breakaways and stuff like that because it's sort of like a do or die play. And I think you're better off just staying in your butterfly and trying to defend normally. But in this situation, you're already in such a tough spot that you just kind of roll the dice and hope it goes your way. And, you know, it didn't.
Well, and again, this isn't, you know, two fourth liners on the ice. These are two of the best players who are going to be NHLers very, very soon. So, you know, you're going to expect the execution in this situation to be pretty high level and the shot to be pretty good. So if you're going to sit there and bank on Logan Cooley or Jimmy Snuggerud missing the net, you're going to be wrong a lot. And I didn't particularly hate it once you could see what he did. I don't really think you fault him for that. And like you said, it's a 2-on-0. What do you want? You know, you're not supposed to save many of those. So it's 2-2. And then Michigan gets called for a trip on a period that they're kind of controlling. They give up, a little bit of a goofy odd man rush. And then Luke Hughes is called for a trip for bringing a guy down in the slot. It's definitely the right call. He bizarrely kind of tries to attack the Gopher coming down the slot. Sort of like if a safety sees a wide receiver running with the ball, or running back, I guess, at him, and he tries to come up to stop him. Like, you just take yourself out of the play so easily there instead of sort of ceding some ground. But Hughes does that, doesn't make the play, swings his stick around, trips him. You know, the shot, I think, ends up going in the net after Portillo's hit, and the net comes off, so it's not a goal. But, you know, that's just, I don't know that he had a ton of better options. It's just that that was probably always going to result in some sort of a penalty.
So there's a few things here.
Okay.
In comparison to a different, very similar play that happens in the third period, this involves a Haas. This is Matthew Nyes. This okay. is a very, very good player who has elite hands.
Yeah.
So that's already different than the one we'll talk about in the third period. So it's a little more understandable when you get juked out of your skates. Still not good. I mean, Luke, you know, just...
But he plays it aggressively, doesn't he?
Yeah, and I would rather him step up and clock the dude than I would
go for the
step
puck.
Up and get for the poke check.
Yeah.
Especially against this particular player, because he's got the hands fast enough to draw it to the forehand there. And you're not playing the body, you just get toasted. And Nyes is around him in tight to the net, and he has only one choice, which is to trip him. And so now it's a power play, and now this is another situation where you need a big kill.
And kill did they do, because I thought that Michigan probably had just as good a scoring opportunities as Minnesota did on this one, where you had Estapa coming in again on the kill, and he hits the iron with a chance, and Fantilli had a chance walking in inside the dot that Close made a save. Michigan actually had two or three pretty good looks on the penalty kill there. I didn't have Minnesota down for a whole lot. They, you know, Portillo made a save early, but this was not only a really good penalty kill, but it was sort of what you brought up last week, that Ohio State does a lot, is a power kill.
Yeah, this was a good penalty kill for Michigan, for sure. You know, what I'll say about that shorthanded chance that hits the iron, you look back at the period, because once Michigan gets back to, you know, gets back to even strength, there's a snuggeroot hits the post at one point at the end of the period. And so when Estapa hits the post there, it was like, man, you just get that goal.
Yeah.
You know, we'd be back in front and we're in business, momentum shifts. But then by the end of the period, I was like, I don't care as much about that, because they hit the post. And,
kind of a wash.
And then it becomes more of a wash.
Well, Michigan was able, after killing that off, they finally got their first power play and only power play of the game. Actually, the last power play of the game between these two teams. For Minnesota's called for holding. Michigan goes on the power play, and actually thought they did a pretty good job. They moved the puck pretty well. I think they got three shots in 2 minutes. They had the best look was would have been for Fantilli on the dot, that they got the puck to him, but he couldn't release it first time. And if he hits it one time, then you can see the opening between Close and the post, but he just can't get it off. And that wasn't really there. Minnesota did get a 2-on-1 on their penalty kill that Portillo made a save on. And, you know, Michigan's power play was fine, but they didn't get a goal. They moved it well. And this also had the feel that, you know, you're just probably not going to get a lot of chances on the power play in this game, because you're nearing the end of the second period. It's a 2-2 game, and you know you're probably not going, the refs are not going to hijack a third period with a bunch of penalties in a game that's this of this importance, that's this close. And so it would have been nice if they could have gotten one, but they didn't.
I think one thing to point out here, and this sometimes I see people a little all over the place on this point, there isn't a major change, at least in the NHL, between playoff refereeing and regular season. This gets talked about a lot. People claim there are less penalties in the playoffs. There aren't. It's the exact same. It changes in overtime, sure.
Yeah.
It changes late in games to some degree, but they kind of leave those alone in regular season anyway. So the whole, like, playoff whistle thing, I don't think is, like, a major difference. Like, you're less likely to get maybe, like, a 13 power play game where one team gets 7 and one team gets 6, sure. But, like, there are going to be power plays, and this just happened to be a cleaner game. They didn't feel like calling any of the borderline stuff, but I think that was established by that point.
Yeah.
I don't think it was the case that, like, if murder had been committed in the third period, they would have swallowed the whistle.
No.
Like, there were going to be more power plays if the teams were doing it. But this was a game without a ton of physicality. I don't recall many plays at all that we sat there and were like, where's the call? Like,
no.
These teams weren't committing penalties, and if that's the case, then fine.
We had a couple on the watch-along early that we were like, oh, that could be a call. But that was, we're used to watching, you know, some really tightly called Big Ten games.
Yeah.
And this was not one of those. This was more of a, all right, we're going to let you play a little bit here, and it's not going to be a special teams fest, which, I mean, I think plays to Michigan's advantage generally, because they've struggled on the penalty kill, and their power play has been probably good overall. It's been not maybe as good as we'd wanted it to be, but it's been fine. And so, but when Michigan doesn't take penalties and they are skating 5-on-5, usually they're as good, if not better, than whoever they're playing against. And that even proved to be the case on Saturday night against Minnesota.
Yeah, I mean, this was a really competitive battle between two teams. I did think Minnesota was really the better team in the final minutes of that second period. Thought Michigan was on their heels when Minnesota hit the post there.
Yep.
And it kind of felt like, just get to the intermission and then we'll reassess.
Well, they had a breakaway like in the last like 3 seconds, right? And that Portillo had to save or hit the post, I guess. But so we get to the intermission. It's 2-2. And, as a fan, this is really all you can ask for. Everything is right there on the table in front of you. You have one period to decide who the better team is. And Minnesota probably slightly better team in the first period because they took advantage of that Michigan mistake. And then Michigan slightly better team in the second period because of the offense that they generated early and cashed a couple chances. And so this is it. This is the rubber period, as they would say, or I would say. And here we go. So Michigan gets their first and only odd man rush just as the third period comes underway. It's actually a 3-on-1. And, we debated this a little bit too. Nazer comes in down the left and he has a couple guys to his right. Looks like he has in pretty good position to shoot the puck as he's inside the dot, but elects to pass it across. Hits the guy on the wing who fires pretty much one time. It goes off really well, but the defenseman guesses and plays it right, gets across, dives, and smothers the shot. And that was the only odd man rush Michigan had. You and I both kind of said, shoot the puck, but on review, it was kind of like, well, it wasn't a bad decision. The guy just also made a play.
On review, it was also a bad shot. He shot it into the guy. Like, I've said this before. I'm generally in favor of just shooting reflexively in odd man rushes just because I think that, generally speaking, most really good teams you're playing are going to be competent enough defensively to take away a lot of passes, and I'd rather get a shot versus no shot. Depends on who the puck carrier is and all that stuff, but credit to Nazer, he did get the pass across. I don't remember who took the shot, but it was not a very good one.
Yeah. And then right after that, this isn't an odd man rush, but Rhett Pitlick gets out in transition against Steve Holtz, and you have a 1-on-1 with Holtz basically going backwards, and Pitlick just kind of plays like when you play with your dog and you have the ball and you kind of move it from side to side, and he kind of like just, the dog just jumps and follows you wherever you go, like just give me the ball. Pitlick just sort of like crosses his puck handling from left to right, left to right, left to right, and Steve Holtz just follows it back and forth until he wobbles over and falls down, and then Rhett Pitlick just snipes a shot and beats Portillo. And, that's not Steven Holtz's strength, is skating and playing the puck. What you mentioned, and you could see clearly on replay, he needed to step up and remove Pitlick from the puck and take him out and not try to clear the puck into the corner.
Yeah, this is just real bad. There's no real way to... And the funny thing was, I remember, because we were getting in some feisty conversations on the watch along around this time.
Oh.
And I was saying, because what I always talk about is when I make statements about things, it's always assuming a vague level of competency from your defense. And so, like, right before it happened, I was like, right, but, like, you know, blah, 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 this isn't, you know, and I remember saying, like, one-on-ones, like, should never be a goal, right? Like, a one-on-one, if you've got competent defense, like...
You should be able to...
You keep them away from a dangerous area, and then you expect your goalie to make a save.
Yeah.
Like, it's not that hard.
Yeah.
And this is, like, what I talked about with the nice thing. This shouldn't be that hard either. Rhett Pitlick is not a superstar NHL talent. Like, if this happens to you, and it's Connor McDavid with the puck, and he's coming 150 miles an hour, and you're and you have no idea how to set your gap because it's just a freight train coming. Like, that's a different thing.
Yeah.
If it's Pavel Datsyuk, it's a different thing. Although that is a little bit easier. But, like, you can't let this happen to Rhett Pitlick. Give me a break. Like, that's just. Because the thing is, he's not skating fast.
Yeah.
He's in, like, slow motion.
Yeah.
And has time to do, like, 15 back-and-forth dangles.
Yeah.
And any point in there, Steve Holtz, it's not like he's playing, you know, a 10-foot gap. He's right there.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, he's like a cat trying to go after a laser pointer and, you know, in tracking the puck instead of just playing the body. The guy's a foot in front of him. Just reach your arms out.
And just
you
remove
can probably
him.
Touch him
yeah.
from that just, distance.
Just...
It's,
just take him take him off the puck.
And like instead he's like, oh, over here, whoa!
And then he falls over.
And it's just like, no, don't focus on the puck, focus on the man in front of you and just play the body, keep him in front of you.
So if you're Nick Blankenberg,
because
that's a little...
you'd even be better off throwing away your stick and just skating backwards and just saying, just keep you in front of me.
Yeah.
Just keep you in front of me.
And, just shoot through me.
Yeah, just through me. You'd be better off doing than what he tried to do there.
But and if you're, like I said, if you're Nick Blankenberg, it might be a little different because you're a smaller guy and you maybe don't have the physical advantage in that
Nick
situation.
Nick liked to hit, though.
Okay. Well, find me a 5'8" defenseman and give me that name.
I think Quinn Hughes would have been your better.
Okay,
example.
If you're Quinn Hughes... And you're backing up like that, and you have your thing is you have great, like, hand-eye coordination, and you control your stick really well. Like, then, yeah, that's a different thing. But Steve Holtz, that's not his thing. He's also massive.
Yeah.
And he's huge. So use your hugeness and take him off the puck. And he didn't, and it temporarily cost Michigan the lead. And, you know, I wasn't feeling like it's over now, but you're like, well, that's just really disheartening.
Yeah, it was definitely going to be tough if you lose the game because some of the things we saw happen with defensemen
in transition,
doing pretty basic defensive stuff.
Yeah, but Michigan does respond. They get a really good look for Mackey, and Close makes a very nice save right after that, and then they get the tying goal where Casey shoots from the point, hits kind of high and up in the corner. McGroarty's in front for a screen. I think he also got an assist on this one. This was the one I was thinking, not the other one where he assisted on his own goal in the second one. This is the one that he ended up getting the assist on. And then also, you know, gets the fake assist for providing the screen in front of Close, and Casey picks a corner. Casey didn't have the greatest night as he'd fallen asleep a couple of times, once on a breakaway and once on that 2-on-0. He was both caught up by ice, but definitely made up for it by tying the game in the early third period.
Yeah, this is just a good old-fashioned, you know, 2006 goal. Not a slap shot, but through tons of traffic, goaltender, you know, getting screened a little bit, and it finds its way through.
Minnesota gets a few chances after that. One of them is blocked, another one goes wide, and then they hit another post. And, you know, they're kind of a little bit on the verge. But then the person who you would say is going to be at the biggest disadvantage and the biggest ice for Michigan, Dylan Duke, makes a play. And he gets a really nice pass from TJ Hughes, who's sitting up at the blue line, puts it on his stick. He cuts back to his right, goes forehand, backhand, goes around through the slot, top of the crease area, around a diving Justin Close, sits on Captain. Is it Faber? I think it was. I think it was.
Closer.
It was the captain for Minnesota. Goes around him and scores just inside the post on a very Dylan Duke goal where he makes a nice little move right in tight and beats a goalie sitting on a defenseman.
It was Faber. You know, this is a weird one because Brindley takes a shot that looks like it's going to get out, and Nyes, and I think it's Cooley trying to get out with him, and it hops down behind them, and all of a sudden Michigan now is still in the zone, still with possession, and so then the pass comes down diagonally to Duke in front. Who made the pass there?
I think it was TJ Hughes.
TJ Hughes, yeah. Pass down, and this is just a situation where I would have to – I don't think we have the angle to really see exactly what is going on. No, let me look here. Now they go off screen. I don't know how Duke gets inside leverage on Faber, but when the puck plops down on TJ Hughes' stick, all of a sudden it's Duke boxing out Faber in front of the net. And so he's able to make that pass down, and Duke's, you know, got the inside leverage on the goalie and is able to just kind of do one little move around close, who came out pretty far, and then slide it under him for the goal.
So here we are again, 8 minutes to go in the game, Michigan with a one-goal lead.
Was that when the brain-dead challenge happened, or was that on a different goal? Did you write that down when that was?
Oh, that...
I think it was this goal.
Wasn't that the third goal?
Was it the third one?
Well, maybe it was this one. No, I did not. So you want to talk about the challenge?
No, I can put it in the column. They didn't... I have to go back and watch that again, but my understanding is that the broadcasters didn't understand it at all.
I don't think this was the Duke goal. I think this was
the previous one.
I think it was the Casey goal.
Okay.
Where...
Yeah, you're right, because this was the one I was initially looking for goaltender interference, and then we saw the replay, and it was like, oh, nothing there, and then they dropped the puck right away.
And they
so
couldn't...
it was the Casey goal with the challenge.
Well, the challenge was, what you were talking about, was for offsides.
Yeah.
And the puck comes out of the zone.
The reason I thought it was this one, because there was also a weird thing right near the blue line, too.
Yeah.
And I don't remember how the plays linked together. But anyway, there was a really weird challenge, and they didn't win it, and the broadcasters seemed very confused, and that's all we need to say about that. And it'll be in the game column, which will be already published by the time you're listening. So
that's circuitous. So anyway, we are 8 minutes away from a Big Ten title in Minneapolis. They, like I said, they've been there a couple of times before. They couldn't close it out. You had made the statement that if this game goes to overtime, it'll be 4-4.
I said that when it was 3-3, by
correct,
the way.
You did. And Michigan then gets the goal, and there's just, it's not really the sense of impending doom, because Michigan has pulled a couple of these out, but you just sort of like, all right, well, the horses are getting ready and there's going to be a cavalry charge. And, you know, you could just kind of feel it coming. And for the most part, I thought Michigan handled it pretty well. Portillo made a pretty good save on a chance, put the rebound in the corner. He didn't have many rebound chances. There was one later in the game that he did, and it ended up costing Michigan an icing. But there was also a couple instances with the net coming off that favored Minnesota. But the fans did not realize that and booed the net coming off, even though Michigan was on the verge of clears for both of those. I think one of them was earlier in the game on a power play, and another one was later on in the game during like a scrum in front.
Yeah, the net coming off thing is one of the more confusing things that fans are upset about in this circumstance. Because, look, I watch maybe like 7 games a year at Mariucci, and I see this happen every single time.
In the same net.
The same net. It's the west end. It's the one on the right if you're watching on TV.
Yeah.
And, like, if you're a Minnesota fan, you haven't figured that out. I don't know what to tell you.
You probably watch more games there than we do.
Yeah, like, this happens there all the time. And I don't know why. And it's not always the opposing goalie that does it. It's happened when it's, you know, their goalie.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Brymack was in a feud with some Gopher fans about that this morning. And all you have to do is just go on Google, or not Google, do the Twitter search, right?
Yeah.
And just type in, like, Minnesota net dislodged, and you find tweets from, like, 2 years ago of Minnesota fans complaining about this. Like, it's a well-established thing. Like, I don't know. And there was the one where it came off that Portillo made the save on
Yeah.
The one. They were like,
anyway.
Oh, it disallowed the goal. It's like, no, it didn't. Like, he made the save.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. It was extremely not worth the time.
So Michigan takes an icing with 2 minutes left, and they call their timeout. It's getting close. It's getting tense. You know, now you're in the, like, having a one-goal lead with 8 minutes left is not one of those, well, we have to win this now. Now, it's a sign for Michigan in the sense of, hey, you're getting your third crack at a win here. It'd be nice to get one. But it's not like one of those situations where you score and you're like, the win is imminent.
It depends on how you're classifying it.
Okay.
Because it's not a situation where if you don't win, it's the choke of the century.
No.
But it is a situation that, if I'm being frank here, you know, I'm a coach of a team, and we're in a big game like this one,
yeah,
or we're trying to clinch a playoff series, and we got a goal with, you know, one goal lead with 8 minutes to go. You got to win.
Yeah.
Get it done. Right? Like, that's the way I viewed it.
But it's not like blowing
because I feel like if you get to overtime having blown that lead, it's not great.
Yes.
That your momentum and the where you are, like, you got to finish that off.
I agree with you, but it also is not the same as blowing, like, a 2 or 3 goal lead.
Sure.
So, but once you start getting down to, like, you kill the first 6 to 7 minutes, now you're like, well, we got to win. Like, now you're within 2 minutes, a minute. It's, you know, two to three shifts that you got to win those specific situations. They pull their goalie, and Michigan starts with under 2 minutes. You know, Michigan takes a couple shots at the empty net. I thought Michigan did a good job against the extra attacker. There were not those, like, oh, three posts and a couple things went wide and Michigan's chasing all over their defensive zone. You know, they held their structure pretty well. They didn't really cede great chances. Portillo maybe had to make a save or two, but, you know, that's fine. You know, he's also on the ice to do a job. And, you know, Michigan, I thought, played that end-of-game scenario pretty well.
Yeah, I think that the only thing I remember from this is the one where he didn't catch it, and they couldn't get a change.
And they had to ice it.
But that's it.
Yeah.
And I could go back and watch and tell you what happens, but that's all you need to know.
Yeah.
If you don't remember anything from it, that's good. So then
they do get clears. It's not like they were holding on for dear life. They got clears, and that's how they won the game in the final 30 seconds. And that's what you want to see, is being not like aggressive, but you want to see active wins in that sense, not hoping just to hold out a little bit longer, but to be like, no, we could do this for another minute. And that's what Michigan did, and it hung them a banner.
Yeah, they played a good game. It's a weird one because, you know, I kind of feel like Michigan was both the better team and the luckier team. They deserved to win the game, and their goals were also weirder than Minnesota's, right? Minnesota's, where it's like all three of these are like, oh, like, you know, very nicely skilled plays, and Michigan got some fortunate bounces in many of their goals. But at the end of the day, Michigan had more chances and was the better team, so no complaints.
All right, well, let's take a break, and we will give you a preview of next weekend's NCAA tournament and the teams that are playing in it.
I can't believe I'm doing this. If you find yourself in the penalty box, you want a Michigan man arguing your case, call criminal law attorney and former prosecutor Jonathan Paul tonight. It's 248 and 924 9458. Or visit his old website at MichiganLawGrad.com.
Pages from a magazine, been looking for the answers ever since we were 17. You know the truth can be a weapon to fight this world of ill intentions. A new answer to the same question, how many times will you learn the same lesson? Just scary, it's about to be legendary.
right, so after we're done hanging one banner, now we'll look at who's alive to hang other ones. As we had mentioned, you know, Michigan gets the three overall by the slimmest of margins over Denver. I think, and did you watch the selection show? Did you have it muted, or was it unmuted for you?
I was watching.
Did you have it muted?
No.
Did you see the interview with the guy on the committee who said this is like the tightest it's ever been
between two teams? They already unveiled the bracket by that point.
So you had gotten distracted and...
No, that's when you change the channel. Okay. You watch to find out the bracket. The bracket's unveiled. Now it's time to watch something else.
Okay. So I did not do that. I kept watching and heard the interview. And the guy said that this is the tightest it's ever been between two teams. And it went out, I think, 6 decimal points to find who had to be ranked higher, and it was, you know, Michigan by a hair, and then that's how they set the field. So Michigan will be heading to Allentown, Pennsylvania for the second year in a row in the Midwest Regional that is not located in the Midwest or close to the Midwest. Penn State will be their 2 seed because they are hosting, and that's the only reason, not because that they probably should be in that regional or based on skill, which, you know, we can talk about benefits Michigan. Their 3 is Michigan Tech, which is a bit of a surprise. You had previously thought maybe Minnesota State, maybe Western, but it is Michigan Tech. And 4, maybe the biggest shock of all, is the Toothpasters, who go through Quinnipiac and Harvard in single elimination tournaments just to get into the tournament, and Colgate is your 4.
So are we breaking down this bracket right now? Were you just prefacing this?
Oh, I was. I figured we'd talk about Michigan's regional now.
Okay. Yeah, this was a... what?
Just funny. Go ahead.
This was a... the break of the century is what we'll say about what unfolded on Saturday night.
You think it was that big?
To get Colgate?
Well, yeah, but I mean, who else were they? They would have gotten Merrimack, right?
Yeah.
Who is not...
That's a huge difference.
Okay.
So, you know, a few things happened. The funny thing was, Saturday afternoon, and maybe Friday night, sometime in there, after the games on Friday were over, I was looking at the, you know, the pairwise probability, all that stuff, and I was like trying to find the ideal scenario in the rooting guide for the next day, and the truth was, it was just impossible.
Yeah, I remember
you wrote
that.
There were too many outcomes, and also it wasn't clear what was preferable. It wasn't really clear how to get it all to shake out exactly. And I don't know what the perfect scenario I could have cooked up in that situation was, but this has got to be close to it because everything had to fall perfectly to get this exact scenario.
Well, I mean, you look at the slim margins in pairwise.
To get Michigan up to 3, to get Colgate in, to get Colgate lined up with QPAC, right? Because if that team is Northern, it doesn't happen.
Yep.
If that team is Alaska, it doesn't happen. Then you had to get Colgate in, then you had to get the flip. I mean, there was so much convoluted stuff that had to happen. You had to start with the Denver thing on Friday afternoon, losing to Colorado College. Like, a lot of things fell Michigan's way to get them this bracket. And they are in a very favorable situation in the first round. I think the second round is going to be interesting, and we'll talk about that. I think there was a better possible bracket they could have gotten in that second round, but didn't ultimately get it. That said, you take that first round every day of the week.
So it's kind of funny because I'm in the process of writing the NCAA tournament preview guide for, you know, all the teams and doing the thing that we do the last few years for it. And, you know, I wrote down the teams and I started kind of writing about them, and I was like, this looks like last year's bracket. You know, they get an automatic qualifier that's in the 20s in pairwise. So they're not getting a team that's on the bubble. They're getting a team that's significantly out that gets in. Now, last year it was, you know, they were the 1 seed, so they got Atlantic Hockey. And, you know, Colgate's probably better than Canisius, but not to the point of where they were almost in the tournament. And then you get, like, the worst 2 seed, which last year they got, that was Quinnipiac because they were the 8 seed, and this is the 8 seed in Penn State. And then you get the third team, and well, I guess the other thing is, like, if you look at Penn...
Now, Harvard's the worst. I mean, by pairwise, yes, but Harvard's the worst 2 seed.
So you think that
Penn State's
you'd rather face Harvard than Penn State?
Yes. Penn State's a better two seed, I think.
Well, but also when you look at the two teams, Penn State kind of fits a little bit the mold that St. Cloud State was last year as the three, and Quinnipiac and Michigan Tech are kind of similar. Michigan Tech is more of a defensive-oriented team that doesn't score a lot, but they have a good goalie. Penn State's a free flow, and we're going to shoot, we're going to score, and don't look at our goalie or our defense because it's not completely there. And that's very similar to what Michigan drew last year, where you're going to get these two competing styles in their opposite game, while they have, you know, as close to a sure thing as you can get in the first round. I mean, their Kratz rating is what? Like, it's their probability is what, like almost 82, 81.5%.
Yeah, the Michigan probability in that first round is very high. It's about 5% lower than it was last year, but it's still very, very big. The Merrimack probability against QPEC is 72.6%. Against Michigan, that probably would be like 70 or 71. So you get a 10 to 11 point boost in getting Colgate over Merrimack. That's a big deal. Like, you know, it's the difference between being a 300 hitter and a 200 hitter.
So
that's a big deal.
Yeah. So I'll go through some of Colgate's numbers a little bit. They're in the ECAC, which is a conference that you and I both are not super thrilled by and take overly seriously. They're 34th in Corsi, which is, you know, I don't know. Maybe it's good if you're Colgate. But they're 21% on the power play, which is not bad at all. They're 84% on the penalty kill, which is pretty good. They have two drafted skaters, two guys that score over 0.75 points per game. So a little bit of mini star power there. Their goalie numbers are GAA is 2.31 and a save percentage of 918. The one thing that they are is pretty hot. They've won five in a row, and two of them are against, you know, two top 10 teams by pairwise and two teams that are in the tournament.
So the first thing you always got to do when you're playing a team like Colgate from the ECAC is take all those numbers you just said and throw them out the window. And look at
should we have Patrick edit this?
Look at when they play non-conference teams.
Okay,
right, because this is what we talk about with the ECAC. Think about Quinnipiac. If Quinnipiac's in Michigan's region, we'll talk about them in a minute.
Can you talk about Quinnipiac? Can you talk about when they play Quinnipiac and Harvard?
Not really, because it's the same kind of games. It's this conference. None of these guys want to play any sorts of offense, and like it's you have to get those kind of out of conference comparisons to get a feel for what's going on here, right? And so they, in their non-conference games, here's who they play in the non-conference. Ready for this?
Yeah.
Northern.
Yeah.
ASU, Merrimack, Vermont, Niagara, and Maine.
So one kind of team.
Yes. They had 48.7% of even strength shot attempts in those games.
Which is, yeah.
They were minus five goal differential in those games.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is a team that did not play a lot of great teams in non-conference and were below water in those games. There's two ways to view Colgate. You can view them in the context of D1 college hockey, and if you believe that everyone in college hockey is on equal footing overall, and we believe that Lindenwood is just as valid and loved as Minnesota,
yeah,
then we could say Colgate is an average team.
Yeah.
If we believe that there are about 20 to 30 real teams,
yeah,
Colgate is really bad.
Yeah.
Because they're about the worst of those 20 to 30 real teams. And that's kind of the situation here. You go into this game saying we're very clearly the better team. If Colgate beats Michigan, I'd be surprised.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't be shocked, but I would be surprised.
Because you can't be shocked in one game
you
elimination
anymore. You can be
shocked
anymore in one game in this tournament, but it's not this one. Colgate is better than the other team we'll get to.
Okay.
And, you know, you have to show up. You have to play well to win these sorts of games. But this is a game you're heavily favored in.
Yeah.
And to get that at any point in the bracket is just a massive deal.
Yeah. Well, there's only really...
Like, compare them to Merrimack.
Right.
Merrimack is a real team from a real conference. I mean, Merrimack played these guys and caved them in at even strength. And it was a split in the series, but 8-5 goals on aggregate. And, you know, how is Colgate going to win this game? They're going to get outshot in shot attempts at even strength, probably 70-35. And they'll need their goalie to play really well.
They're going
to,
yeah.
That's the only way they can win this game. And that goalie is Carter Guylander.
Yep.
He's
been good.
Yep. That and so he. The funny thing is, I saw that name. I was like, man, that one looks familiar. And then it turns out, oh, it was a Red Wings seventh rounder years ago in 2019. You know, 918 save percentage. I don't watch the ECAC because I have self-respect. And so it's hard for me to know how to adjust that because it's Colgate. It's not Quinnipiac.
Yeah.
Quinnipiac's goalie has 918. He's bad.
Yeah.
If Colgate, less clear because, yeah. They're much closer. I mean, the thing with the ECAC is always, like we talk about, is five of those 12 teams are among the five just worst in the country.
Really, really,
really,
really,
really bad.
Yeah.
And it just clogs your stats. It turns your penalty kill into, you know, Mickey Mouse numbers. It turns your power play into Mickey, you know, just all those stats become less interesting because it's just clogged. And so when you kind of get outside that, they've allowed 29 goals in their 12 non-conference games. So not too bad.
Yeah.
But they only scored 24. So it's not a very high-scoring team. They don't have a lot of talent. Again, what we talked about. They're just going to need the goalie to be hot on that day and Michigan to miss the net a lot of times, and then they'll need a few bounces and get a 2-0 lead and then just try and park the bus and put five guys in front of the net and hope the seeing eye shot doesn't get through. We've seen this game before. But if Michigan gets a lead, it's probably over.
Yep. And that's why, you know, a couple of the things I just said are, I mean, it's basically what we wrote about AIC last year is in some senses copy and paste, because it's the same kind of game. And, you know, like you said, Michigan's win probability for Cratch is slightly lower, but not that much lower. And it's a very similar kind of team that they're going to be facing. So what do you need to do? Well, like you said, get a goal or two early and, you know, don't do anything dumb. I mean, don't take a major, right? I mean, that's just, like, don't put yourself in a really big hole. Give yourself a number of chances, go get the game, and you'll probably be fine.
Yeah, you just want to get that first goal and not be playing from behind. And last year, Michigan got it very early in the AIC game, and then
we're
just kind of solidly in control the rest of the way. You know, I think overall this is a pretty classic first overall seed against Atlantic Hockey champions sort of game.
Yeah.
That, like, this is what the normal one is.
Yeah.
Michigan isn't first overall, and this isn't the Atlantic Hockey champion, but that's this sort of game.
Because
this year the Atlantic Hockey champion's a lot worse than normal.
Because they're like a five seed in their conference tournament.
So, but this is like a classic one of those. And it happens. Right? AIC beat somebody 1 year. RIT won like a couple times. Air Force won one time. Like, it happens. So, yeah, Michigan could lose, but they
shouldn't.
They definitely shouldn't. And there are very few times you can say that in this cursed tournament.
Cursed. The other game in Michigan's regional, Penn State versus Michigan Tech. Penn State, obviously, we've seen a few times. They are not completely who they've been. They're still Penn State. They still like to shoot a lot. Their goalie has been maybe better than in the past, but he's still not great. Their defense, I mean, we saw them at Yost, and Michigan kind of spun their defense in circles, especially on that Saturday game. But, you know, they're a team that behind a raucous environment, like they could have, you know, they will have the puck a lot. They will shoot a lot, and, you know, if those shots go in, they don't have, like, the same star power that they maybe have had in the past, but, you know, they have, like you said, they have a number of guys that will, two or three lines of guys that will put the puck in the net.
Penn State's a fine team. We've seen them plenty of times. I'm not scared of them in any way. There's nothing about them that concerns me. They're a fine team. You could lose, but, like,
the one thing I find,
the Carolina Hurricanes of college hockey, and what does Carolina never do in you know, playoff style games? They don't get it done a lot of times. That teams that just take a ton of shot attempts and don't value quality of attempts, and teams that, you know, have a little more questionable goaltending at times in these sorts of tournaments don't often win a lot.
Do you think that's a little bit reflective? Because they're in this stat, and their power play percentage is only at 15%, and usually they've been pretty good on the power play, and this year it has dropped off kind of significantly. And so a lot of times power play is, you know, who are your best players, and can they score when they're an advantage on the ice? And a lot of times when you get power plays that are loaded with really good players, the answer to that is yes. And if your power play isn't very good, it's either because you don't do something right structurally, which I kind of am doubting given what Penn State has done in the past, or it's that you just don't have great shooters.
Yeah, they don't have great shooters. We know that. And we've seen Michigan play them. And Michigan grew up a lot, some amount, between November and January, but then another big chunk from January to now. So it would be a different sort of game. And that first series was so weird. Like, that Friday night game, Michigan is just asleep. It's not clear what was going on there.
Portillo was sick.
He was not available, and it seemed like the whole team was sick. They had no energy.
They played like they were.
That was just it wasn't like they were playing and being overwhelmed. Like, they just weren't winning any races. Like, it just it looked like they were just
drugged or something.
Yeah, very strange game. And then Michigan was way better in the Saturday game before sort of the Quinnipiac regional final meltdown from last year, where they just let things cascade and then they win in overtime. And then you have the two games at Yost, and you had a...
Well, one of those games, I mean, they'd have overcome leads in both of them from Penn State.
Well, the Saturday game is just crazy with
the two goals
the major
in the minute.
And the just... So you have these high event games. There's a lot going on. There's a lot to talk about in those kinds of matchups. So, but I'm very comfortable playing Penn State. This is a team that finished sixth in the Big Ten standings out of seven teams that coaxed their way into the two seed because they Alaska it up. I mean, they cooked the books on pairwise. They never faced.
Well, and they probably got a boon from, well, I guess Canisius didn't have a great year, but they made the tournament.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, I mean, Penn State, this is what they do. Like, we talk about the holes in pairwise that allowed Arizona State to get in and allowed Alaska to come so close.
Yeah.
You want to talk about holes, talk about Penn State.
Yeah.
And played a real team in like 7 years in the non-conference, and they get a two seed out of it.
And
here's their non-conference. Canisius, Mercyhurst, St. Thomas, Alaska, RIT. For a Big Ten team, that's a joke. Absolute joke.
Who's the best
if
team
I'm
then?
If I'm a USCHO voter, remember when Graham Couch said he wouldn't vote for anyone in the top 25 if they didn't play a true road game in the non-conference?
Well, yeah.
That's going to be me. If I'm a USCHO voter, I will not vote for any team that does not schedule a Hockey East or NCHC or Big Ten, right? Depending on what conference you're in.
Yeah.
In the non-conference.
Well,
you're just not a top 25 team. Like, you don't deserve it.
And
play real teams.
The last couple of years,
Minnesota's out here playing like St. Cloud and Denver and Michigan's booking BU and Western and
Harvard.
And Penn State's like going through the phone book of the Atlantic hockey teams. Like, hello, Canisius, would you like to play?
You want to get spanked?
We got Air Force next. They had us on hold. Now we're calling Mercyhurst.
St. Lawrence was busy. Yeah, no, I don't disagree with that. I mean, the only kind of thing, and we talked about this in prep a little bit, it doesn't seem to faze you. You know, they will fill up this building. If they beat Michigan Tech, Michigan's going to be outnumbered in fans by, you know, probably 16 sections to one or two.
So how many fans do you think will be there?
For Penn State?
Yep.
I think if they win and this game is on a Sunday night, it'll be pretty full.
Give me a number.
What does the arena hold? Hypothetically, I mean, if you give me, if you give me
8,500,
I bet it's at least three quarters full on Sunday night. If it's Michigan Penn State, I bet they actually put people there.
So let's say it's 66,200.
Okay,
how many of those are suiting up?
Well, I mean, some people, you know, dress like they're in the '50s and they bring like the fedoras and they wear the button down. So there could be some folks that are taking it seriously.
I care about who's on the ice. I care about who's playing in these games. If you want to talk about true game effects of home versus road, then, you know, we can talk about last change and, you know, that kind of thing. Which Michigan will have. So it's not even a road game in that sense. It's otherwise, it's just like, do you believe in ghosts? And I'm just not as swayed by college hockey in that way, unless it's a team that I think is very fragile. There are some teams that I'm like, oh, they're going into a game seven in X arena.
Did you watch one of them lose in a tournament yet in 2 days ago?
Then, yeah. Well, but here's the thing. College basketball, absolutely.
Yeah.
Home and road really matters in college basketball. Really matters in college football.
Yeah.
I'm a lot less persuaded about the sports of baseball and hockey. You see it sometimes in the NHL if a team has a game seven at home, but the President's Trophy in NHL conveys home ice in every round to its victor. And that team has won the cup like one time in 15 years.
But you believe the Lions are cursed?
Again, there are certain cases. but I just don't really believe that Eric Portillo will be scared. If the fans behind him are going crazy, I don't really believe that Adam Fantilli will miss his shot because the fans behind him are going crazy. Like, we've seen this team. We've seen this team go into Minnesota and just win.
Yeah,
like,
you're right.
I guarantee that crowd's going to be crazier than the one in Allentown. And, like, it didn't matter at all. I don't care that much about that.
I think, a factor in these games because a lot of times they are neutral site games, and I don't think this will be a neutral site game. If chalk holds in Allentown to the final, I think this will be sort of a road game atmosphere for Michigan. They'll have the last change and that sort of thing, and it won't be like a whiteout per se, but I do think that there will be a significant crowd advantage against them. And I feel like when we're previewing this, that's worth at least mentioning.
Sure.
Michigan Tech. This team does not play in a real conference, according to you and mostly to me either. Their numbers across the board, not great. They have 13% on the power play. That's bad, isn't it? I don't care who you're playing.
That's really, really bad.
That's pretty bad. But their goalie has been good. And, you know, you may want to adjust his numbers. You don't know maybe what your formula is for adjusting good, bad competition goalie numbers. But, you know, his save percentage is, you know, 0.929, which is, you know, I think anyone would take that.
It's right at the top of the country.
Right. It's also against the CCHA for the most part.
Yeah. The reason I am a lot higher on this is that in their non-conference games, which does have St. Lawrence and Alaska, but also has Western and BU, so it's kind of, you know, a mix. He was 922 in the non-conference games, and he got skunked by Western. All the other games, he was 941. So there's not a lot of difference there.
Yeah.
This is not a great matchup. Not one I love personally.
But goalies, and that's one of the things that you want to avoid. We talked about this: is you want to avoid good/really hot goalies, because that is, it's like facing a pitcher that's just completely on that day. It almost doesn't even matter some of the other things that are involved. You have to deal with something that is almost sometimes unsolvable.
There were people that were like, "This is a rough draw because it's Penn State or it's Michigan Tech with an awesome goalie, or it's Penn State with the fans." And I'm like, those are not the same thing. I am much more concerned about the actual goalie who will actually be playing in the game being very good than I am the ghosts of those wearing the white sweaters in the crowd. No, I mean, this is, you should cheer for Penn State.
So Penn State actually does have a 55%. Cratch chance of winning.
Yep. I mean, Blake Piatela, he's an awesome goalie. He's had a very nice year. Yes, they play easier teams, but this is a guy who does face a lot of shots. He faces 28 shots per game, so it's not like he's Yanev Peretz out here. They don't score at all, so yeah. If they're going to beat Michigan, it's going to be either 2-1 or 3-2, but those are totally reasonable range outcomes because Michigan does not let a lot of teams score less than 3 on them. Yep.
So, do you remember what the score was the last time these two teams played?
It was 0-0. Yep, I remember that. On like December 30th or December 29th.
Michigan had no players and were injured and sick. And
yeah, Portillo was awesome in that game.
Yeah, and he had a bunch of saves.
Yeah.
And they could not they created a bunch of opportunities and they could not finish anything. And that went through overtime, I believe.
So this year, Michigan Tech has been shut out twice. They have 5 games where they scored 1 goal, 12 games where they scored 2 goals, 10 games where they scored 3 goals, only 9 total games where they scored more than 3. This team just doesn't score.
Yeah.
And you know what the formula is going to be here.
Get a goal and lock it down.
And, yep, play from ahead and, you know, work from that direction forward. And
what if there are detractors to what you say, saying that, you know, you don't want to see the goalie, but the truth is you don't want to face them because they're your true arch nemesis?
Look, I'll be happy for them if they win this, you know, if they go through into the Frozen Four.
Even the fans?
Yeah, I mean, this I'd be fine.
The ones that come at you?
They're a fine team. They are from an easier conference, but they have a really good goalie, and we'll see if they can get past Penn State. I just think Penn State plays a style that's more conducive to Michigan. Like, at the end of the day, with the growth that Michigan's made, and I think Liam Sullier's had a fine year, but Portillo's playing well recently. I'd say it's a push in net. And then Michigan's got unquestionably the better shooters.
And defensemen.
Yeah, it's certainly a creating offense. And Penn State wants to play that way, and Michigan's got the better players. Let them play that every day of the week.
That's the thing, is you're not going to find many teams that are going to want to run and gun with Michigan. Penn State is one of them.
It's one of them.
And they probably will not be able to.
Yep.
In one game, you never know. In seven games, you put down money on this series. But unfortunately for Michigan, it's just one game. I would say that I would expect them to come out of this bracket or this regional.
I think if you were doing probabilities here, Michigan would probably be like 40 to 50% to come out. And it would be obviously far higher than the other three teams. So they are the most likely team to come out, but maybe, not more likely than not. I think it'd be very close to even odds between Field versus Michigan.
Sure.
But that's all you can ask for.
Yeah.
Michigan Tech's a tough draw, but I'm not going to cry about that.
No.
Colgate is an easier draw in the first round, and you got to beat real teams to win the national title.
Yep.
And these are two good teams, and they'll test Michigan.
We'll move over to Bridgeport, which would be the regional that Michigan would face should they be fortunate enough to win a couple of games and get to Tampa. And this draw is Quinnipiac, the 1, Harvard, the 2, Ohio State, the 3, and Merrimack, the 4. And that's, that's not maybe the highest end teams, but that's a tough draw. There, you got a lot of teams that are not pushovers there.
Yeah, that's a very interesting region. I think that if you made me pick, typically speaking, a lot of years, at least one seed loses the first round.
Yeah.
If you made me pick which one seed's going to lose, this is easily the clear matchup where that would happen.
Yeah.
Because the other two, Michigan and Minnesota, are both playing,
They should be through the first round.
Way down there.
They
teams.
Should be.
So then you're comparing Denver Cornell, power conference versus mini conference.
Yeah.
And then you get the reverse in the Quinnipiac Merrimack game. And I know Hockey East was down this year, but Merrimack still plays in a real conference. And Quinnipiac, There's no way to break this one down because using stats. Because, again, I mean, I saw this tweet like a week ago. It's like, Quinnipiac has allowed like one total goal in their last like 11 games. I'm like, okay, against Dartmouth?
But that's what they said coming into against Michigan.
Yeah,
and after two periods, it was 4-0.
Yeah, like, it's, I don't care. I don't care about their plus 100 goal differential. It's a Mickey Mouse league. And so they're a good team, no question about it, but they're not invincible, and they're playing a team that has played better teams on a regular basis. And if you had to make me pick one, I would pick this one, probably. So that's one to be on watch for. Harvard, Ohio State's going to be real interesting because Harvard is also in a lower league, but they have players.
I had this as maybe the game of the first round. The only other one that maybe enters
all those 2-3 games are fun.
Yeah, but this one is like, I think it's two teams that do everything pretty well. I mean, the other one would be Minnesota State and playing St. Cloud could be fun too, just because they're both from Minnesota. All those players know each other.
I really like that BU Western game.
You think that's going
to
be good?
Which we'll get to in a bit. But this one's a fun one. Ohio State's battle tested. They've played a lot of teams with good players, but Harvard's got plenty of them themselves. I mean, Sean Farrell had an awesome season in for the Crimson, 52 points in 33 games. And then, you go down that list.
Do you take them a little more seriously because they have so many NHL draft picks?
Yes.
That NHL teams are like, nah, this guy might be able to play.
Yes.
Okay.
Matthew Coronado was a first-round pick. I mean, Alex LeFerrier was a third-round pick. I mean, you have your top three scorers. We're all first through fourth rounders who are scoring more than a point per game, and it gets an easier schedule, yes, but they have players. Henry Thrun, their top defenseman, is also an NHL pick as a senior. that's a nice profile, and they got 925 goaltending for Mitchell Gibson in an easier conference, so it can be solved for sure, but I think that's close to a push in net, most likely, with Ohio State versus Harvard. And,
yep.
And Harvard, here's the other thing. They played a tougher non-conference schedule. So they played, BC and Northeastern because they were in the bean pot. They played BU in Northeastern as well. They went to Michigan. They played New Hampshire. They are pretty battle-tested, too, and this is going to be a very competitive game. And, we'll see what happens.
Yes. They also have been, both teams also have pretty good on special teams, too. So yep. you just have a lot of, both high in Corsi, and I know, like you said, the difference in competition, but the probability ratings here for Kratcher, like under 52 and over 48, like I think that's about as close as it really gets.
Yeah, and Ohio State is favored in the rating system 51.7, but that is, it's a toss-up.
Do you know the other team that Harvard struggled to beat this year? Because they didn't beat Michigan. They tied them in...
No.
I'll give you a hint. They're in the tournament. We've already previewed them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they lost to Colgate in the final.
I think twice.
Yeah.
But anyway, I just thought that was kind of funny. Do you have a leaning as who you like coming out of this bracket, or is this one truly pretty wide open?
I'm not revealing my picks until the tournament preview is posted.
Do you have one in your mind?
Maybe.
You might have a lean?
Maybe.
It took me a while to think about it. I just kind of had to go through and come up with something. But this one seems as pretty wide open as any, because I think all four teams have something that can get them through. In the Fargo Regional is the number one overall Minnesota Golden Gophers. They'll be playing the Canisius Golden Griffins, so you have two teams with two-worded mascots that both begin with G, and so do their adjectives. This matchup is pretty one-sided. I think the only thing that you can kind of say is, hey, anything can happen in a one-game playoff. But aside from that, there is pretty much nothing leading me to believe that Canisius is going to win this game outside of just pure randomness. I guess if Minnesota scores four own goals, that could help.
Yeah, I mean, Canisius played Penn State. They lost both times. Shot attempts were not super even in those games, certainly the first one. Canisius was fourth in Atlantic Hockey.
That's low in Atlantic Hockey.
They're 44th in the rating system. They're well below Wisconsin. Like, they're half as good as Wisconsin in the rating system.
Will you be rooting for them?
Probably, yeah. But if they won this game, it would be one of the biggest upsets.
Ever.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe of any sport.
It's a fold-the-program moment if you lose this game, if you're Minnesota. Like, it just is.
Minnesota State, St. Cloud. This is another interesting one, too. I mean, we kind of touched briefly on it when we were talking about Harvard, Ohio State. But, these schools are in the same state. They recruit probably similar players. A lot of these players played against each other in high school. They know each other. They're not in the same conference now because of a bunch of realignment stuff, but they used to be back in the old WCHA days. And here you have St. Cloud that's probably a little bit more impressive because of the conference that they play in. But, the thing about Minnesota State is, they just tend to do everything well. And they've been battle-tested of going to the tournament repeatedly. They won three games in the tournament last year, beating real teams. And, yeah, they don't have Dryden McKay in net anymore, and so maybe that's going to be a little bit different. But, this is becoming a pretty legitimate program. Michigan played them last year in the non-conference and in probably one of the better games of the year.
Well, that team last year was loaded, and a lot of the skaters are the same, but they don't have the goalie, and that's the big difference. They have a definite downgrade in net, and that's the one way you beat this team. And they've got a lot of good players on their team. Makito Hirose and Livingstone are two of the top UDFA guys that are going to sign when the season's up with whichever team they want. And it's a really talented team. They're playing St. Cloud, who was very good, closed strong in the NCHC, won the NCHC tournament. The one thing about St. Cloud is they don't actually ever win in the tournament.
Yeah.
Like, this is going to be interesting, especially if they get to play Minnesota to have them against Moscow. Because when Moscow was there, that was their thing. they were the number one overall seed once or twice.
Yeah.
They lost both times, I think, or
yeah.
they were high up. I mean, they just don't actually win. They were in the tournament last year. They didn't win the 8-9 game with QPAC. They need a run to shake that little...
They've actually been...
nameplate off themselves and show that they've got it, and maybe this is their year.
They've actually been regionaled with Michigan a few different times, and they've never actually faced them.
Yep.
Because, you know, one of the teams would win, the other one would not. But I find this game to be pretty interesting, too, on a number of different subplots. Obviously, the winner most likely takes on Minnesota. And I would, you know... I think regardless of who wins that game, Minnesota's going to be the favored team to come out of that bracket. I mean, will they?
No doubt.
I don't know, but, you know, that seems pretty obvious. All right, the last regional in Manchester, New Hampshire, where it looked like Michigan was going to go for the last 2 or 3 weeks, is Denver, Boston U, Western Michigan, and Cornell. You like this BU-Western matchup.
Yeah, this is a tough draw for BU. I feel bad for them because Western's a good team. They crashed hard in the NCHC tournament, and that dropped
against CC. And they got swept by CC.
Yeah, and that was weird and rough. But Western's a good team. They finished second in that conference
in
the regular season, ahead of St. Cloud, who we were just talking about as being a good team. And St. Cloud was in that, you know, kind of 8-9 slot, and Western's now all the way down at 12. We saw Michigan play Western and some pretty competitive games, one of which went to overtime. Like, that's Western's a real solid team, and, you know, to kind of get them as your first round matchup is tough when you're fifth overall and you were pretty close to being a one seed.
And you didn't lose.
No.
Like, you were close, but you were hot down the stretch of your tournaments, winning all your games, and just didn't make it.
So, BU's favorite in this game, but it is definitely a...
What are the crouch percentages?
57.1, so they're favorite, but it's not overwhelming.
And BU just... So, lately...
I mean, PSU against Tech is 55%. There's not much difference for a 5-12 versus what is basically like the 8-10 or whatever with the switching going on.
So, the Duluth Sorcerers did not make this tournament, much to the enjoyment of all of us. But it seems that maybe BU has taken on their mantle of just finding ways to pull games out of anywhere. As, you know, they were dead in the water a couple of different times in the Hockey East tournament. You know, we were watching at least one of them. I had both of them on where, you know, they're getting blitzed by Providence, but Providence can't find the net. They finally get the lead. It gets down to the end and BU ties it, wins in overtime. And then similar things happen against Merrimack, where Merrimack has the lead, BU ties it. Merrimack retakes the lead, BU ties it, and then wins in overtime.
Yep.
And, you know, that's sometimes it's better to be lucky than good, right? And right now, that's BU.
Yep.
The other matchup, Denver-Cornell. Denver, obviously, we remember from last year as being the team that took Michigan to almost two overtimes before finally winning off of a bad DZTO. And they will draw Cornell, who is another one of those not terrible ECAC teams, but, you know, not also a top five team. They're usually in around the tournament somewhere on the bubble, if not just inside. I think, you know, Cratch has Denver at about 69% chance to win. So this isn't a terrible draw for Denver either. It's not Atlantic Hockey champion, but it could have been worse.
Yeah, I feel fine about this if I'm Denver. Cornell played Duluth and got swept. Not great.
Was that early in the year?
Yeah, that was in the non-conference, and Duluth was home, sure, but Cornell did get swept, and Duluth got swept by Wisconsin and was 10-14 in the conference. Denver won, so
yeah,
that's a kind of comparison that feels pretty favorable. As well as the simple word ECAC next to Cornell's name.
Three ECAC teams in the tournament.
I know. This is our...
What's going on, Alex?
No, I'd feel very comfortable about this one if I'm Denver.
Who was the guy that was vouching for plural Atlantic Hockey teams
in the tournament? That was in the COVID year when they could just make up whatever. That was amazing. That wasn't college hockey news.
Is it crazier to have three ECAC teams or two Atlantic hockey teams?
Two Atlantic hockey teams by far. Because at least, you know...
If you expanded to 32 teams, would you get two Atlantic hockey teams?
No, there weren't three ECAC teams in the tournament. There's four ECAC teams in the tournament.
There's
three at-larges and one auto bid.
I didn't even think of that.
There are more ECAC teams in this tournament than have made the Frozen Four in the past eight tournaments.
We didn't even go through the breakdown of teams in the tournament. There's four Big Ten teams.
There's four Big Ten teams.
Four ECAC teams.
One Atlantic Hockey.
That's nine.
There are two CCHA teams. There are...
That's 11.
Two Hockey East teams.
And
there are three and
so
teams.
There are more ECAC teams than... They are tied for the most teams in the NCAA tournament. You may have to revise your opinions on the ECAC. What if they get plural Frozen Four teams?
I would be very, very surprised, because two of them and the best two by far are in the same region.
That's true.
Would mean Cornell or Colgate is in the Frozen Four, which, hey, it could happen, but not very likely.
That's true.
I would not be surprised if they have one in, because putting your two best in the same region means you've got a pretty good shot.
Where they're the two best in that region.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
it's unfortunate for the ECAC. If they had Harvard in another
region,
then you're kind of like, okay, but all right. And again, here, I mean, well, I don't know. You know, Denver looks like they're well on their way to being into the regional final. The other game is going to be in kind of knockdown drag out. And so, I mean, Denver's going to have the highest percent chance to get to the Frozen Four because they have an easier first round game. But do you like them over BU? Do you like them over Western? Or is this three teams that have a decent shot?
Well, Denver and Western were in the same, you know, conference, and Denver did sweep them.
They only played twice?
Yeah, they only played twice. I think BU-Denver would be a very, very fun game. It's like that Western-Minnesota game last year, 4-5, where you just hope they both make it and then they can duke it out. But, I wouldn't mind seeing Western there either. It's going to be that's a fun regional. I think there's three legitimate teams with a chance to come out of it, and it'd be fun to see.
So
who does.
We talked about Michigan getting a nice break in their regional. They also get Minnesota, St. Cloud State, Minnesota State, Denver, BU, and Western all on the opposite half. So they can't see two of those teams, and they can only see one of them if they both make the national championship. So I guess if you're looking at Michigan's half of the bracket, who is the one team that you think has the best chance to keep them out of the national championship game? Like, who do you not want to face in the tournament on their half?
I think the two that would alarm me the most are Michigan Tech and Ohio State.
Yeah, I was thinking Ohio State. Now, we just watched them
play really well against them.
Right, so but we've also watched Ohio State play really well against Michigan. Tech bothers you more than anyone else?
I think so, because Pietila is actually probably very good, whereas Yaniv Peretz is most certainly a pretender.
Michigan...
Like, they have the same save
Michigan
percentage,
chased
and
him.
One of them faces 28 shots per game, the other one faces, like, 19.
Michigan chased him last year.
Yes.
Right? Because they brought in St. Cyr for the third period.
Yep.
Who Michigan scored three on, but I believe they were all empty netters, or at least two of them were.
It was a bizarre game.
Yeah, but they did not... light St. Cyr, but they actually did beat Peretz multiple times.
Yep.
Interesting. All right. Well, that is a lot of teams. That is a lot of college hockey talk for one evening. Do you have any closing thoughts about anything that we have discussed? Michigan plays, we didn't tell you the times. Michigan plays the last game of the first round, right? It'll be Friday night at 8:30. Well, I don't know. It'll be Friday night 45 to 50 minutes after the Michigan Tech Penn State game. So right now you're kind of thinking 8:30, overtimes and such can move that along. But I believe that one is on ESPNU.
Yes, I believe it is.
Do you like having Michigan playing last, or would you want them leading off?
I like them playing last because I like watching the games and, you know, nice and relaxed and that whole thing. Sometimes when your team gets knocked out really early in a tournament, then it's like, well, I'm just done watching this tournament.
Yeah.
But then you get to watch all those first round games while being nice and secure. And then hopefully you win that first game, and then you get to watch all the second round games until maybe your team loses.
Yeah, that's true. The one thing that I never mind is sort of like Michigan football playing at noon, where if they go and they win the game, then you come home and you're just like, now I'm just going to have a good day and watch a bunch of it instead of sitting there being like, you know, leading up to it. But, you know, Michigan does have a draw that you're always nervous in single elimination hockey, but they have probably the second best draw in the tournament in terms of the first round. So
yep.
You shouldn't have the added extra gut wrenching that if they continue to move along, we'll certainly be there.
Yeah, it feels pretty accurate.
All right, so hopefully when we talk to you next week, we will be talking about two wins and breaking those down and taking a quick glance potentially at who's still left and Michigan heading for the sunny rays of Florida.
Thank you for listening to Michigan Hockey Cast 5.21. For Alex Drain and David Nasternak, come back next week where we will be talking about something, but we've reached the point in the season where we can't tell you what it is until it happens.